Once again, we'd like to turn to the book of Luke, chapter 23, read the same verses that we read this morning, verse 32 through verse 43. And there were also two other malefactors led with him to be put to death. And when they were come to the place which is called Calvary, there they crucified him, the malefactors, one on the right hand and one on the left, and the other on the left. Then said Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they parted his raiment and cast lots. And the people stood beholding, and the rulers also with them derided him, saying, He saved others. Let him save himself, if he be Christ, the chosen of God. And the soldiers also mocked him, coming to him and offering him vinegar, and saying, If thou be the king of the Jews, save thyself. And a superscription also was written over him in letters of Greek and Latin and Hebrew, This is the king of the Jews. And one of the malefactors which were hanged railed on him, saying, If thou be Christ, save thyself and us. But the other answering rebuked him, saying, Dost not thou fear God? Seeing thou art in the same condemnation, and we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds. But this man hath done nothing amiss. And he said unto Jesus, Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. And Jesus said unto him, Verily I say unto thee, today shalt thou be with me in paradise. Again, this is part of the record of Jesus being crucified between two thieves. It was prophesied in Isaiah 53 and verse 12. All four gospel writers record the fact that Christ was crucified between two thieves, that he laid down his life between two criminals. On the part of man, this was done to show their disdain for Christ, to show that they thought he was a criminal. But the bigger picture, on the part of God, this was done for the salvation of this one particular thief. The Lord knew from the foundation of the world who this thief would be. And he was crucified between two thieves, I believe, for this one. And also to provide valuable lessons for each of us. Because in these two thieves, we see the condition, we see the need of all mankind. We see the miraculous power of the Lord, His gracious willingness to save a helpless sinner. Again, it's a pattern of salvation. It's what happens when someone is saved. And the truths revealed here concerning salvation are glorious. But in this message, we want to view the passage differently. Never preached from it in this way before. We want to view this penitent thief, not as a pattern for salvation, certainly that's the main pattern here, but for living life as a child of God. And that'll be our subject, the penitent thief, a pattern for living life. First thing we need to do is, again, consider the scene in which this took place, because it does picture, especially in the day in which we live, it pictures the world, pictures the conditions in which you and I are called to live. The place where this happened was Calvary. We see that in verse 33. And when they were come to the place which is called Calvary. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or Matthew, Mark, and John, all refer to it as Golgotha. Same place. Mark, in his record, in Mark 15 and verse 22, gave the interpretation of Golgotha. He said it's the place of the skull, of a skull. John records in John 19, verse 17, that Golgotha is the Hebrew name of this place. Calvary, of course, is the Latin name. So it's the same place. There's a Hebrew name, there's a Latin name. Golgotha, Calvary. We know from Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 12 that this place was outside of the city of Jerusalem. We learn from John's account in John 19 that there was a burial ground nearby. This, of course, would be very convenient. So Golgotha or Calvary, whichever one you want to call it by, was a place where the Roman soldiers put criminals to death by crucifixion. So it was known to be a place of suffering. Certainly a place of much distress. Certainly a place of great sorrow for those being crucified and for those who knew them, family. It was a place of sorrow. It was a place of heartbreak. No doubt it was a place of humiliation and indignity and disgrace. It was a place where people would dread. Place where people would fear, look upon with absolute horror. It was a very appalling place, an abominable place. So that's the setting. Then consider the spirit of the scene. We read in verse 48 of Luke 23, and all the people that came together to that site. All the people that came together at that site. The gathering, as you read, consisted of the general public. And no doubt some of them were simply there out of curiosity. Everyone had heard of this Jesus. So many were there just out of curiosity. The religious leaders were there. The military leaders were there. So there's a mass of people gathered that day. And we read in Matthew 27 and verse 36 that some sat down and watched him there. That is Jesus. We read in Matthew 27 and verse 39 that some passed by. That is, some walked by. And as they did, it says that they reviled. That is, they denounced and slandered Jesus Christ. And then in Luke chapter 23, verse 49, we read of those who stood afar off, beholding these things. And some of these, of course, were the Lord's own people. So you have, looking at that crowd, there are people sitting, and their focus is on that center cross. There are people walking by, and as they walk by, their attention is drawn to the center cross. And there are people standing, and their attention is drawn to the center cross. With the exception of the Lord's people that were there, and that would have been very few, because most of them had fled. The spirit and attitude of this crowd was really set before they ever arrived at the place. And then it simply increased as they got closer to the place, and increased even more as they finally arrived at this place. Leading up to the scene, to show that the attitude was already established. Leading up to the scene, Jesus, of course, had been betrayed. He'd been arrested. He was bound and led away to Annas. From there, he would be led to Caiaphas, the high priest, where he was questioned concerning the accusations against him. And it was determined there that he was guilty. Guilty of death. He was spit upon. He was buffeted and smitten. Caiaphas and the council became enraged at the response of Jesus Christ. And the next morning they led him away to Pilate, who was the governor. See, they're going up in authority. They said to Pilate in Luke chapter 23 and verse 2, "We found this fellow perverting the nation." You know, there's a lot of people who believe that today. Jesus Christ perverting the nation. Forbidding giving tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king. Why did they feel that way? Because Christ was telling them something different than their own views. So he was viewed as a perverter of the nation. Pilate questioned Jesus and declared there in Luke 23 and 4, "I find no fault in this man." The response of the people is recorded in verse 5, "And they were the more fierce." So you see what's happening? They're angry, but their anger is intensifying. "And they were the more fierce." The word fierce means savage. They were the more fierce. But it's an interesting word in the New Testament because it is used of the Gadarene demonics. They were exceeding fierce. Same word translated perilous in 2 Timothy chapter 3. So this anger that they were feeling was demonic in origin. And you have to remember that as we approach the scene. It was at this point that Pilate discovered that Jesus belonged to the jurisdiction of Herod. So he sent him to Herod, who of course proceeded to question Jesus, and he found nothing worthy of death in Christ. And notice in verse 11 of Luke 23, "And Herod with his men of war, even though they found nothing worthy of death, set him at naught, mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him again to Pilate." So he's again before Pilate. In verse 33, we see that Pilate called together called the chief priests and the rulers of the people. And he said unto them, "Neither I nor Herod have found anything worthy of death in this man." Pilate, wanting to set Christ free, without compromising himself in the eyes of his superiors, makes reference to a custom that was practiced, and that was the custom of releasing the prisoner during the Passover. And since some prisoner must be released and set free, Pilate thinks, "This is my opportunity to have Christ set free." So he offers to chastise Jesus, though he found no fault in him, and then to set him free and crucify Barabbas, who was the most notorious of all the criminals at that time. But the people, in unison, cry out in verse 18, "Away with this man," that is Christ, and release unto us Barabbas. No, you don't let Jesus go. You set Barabbas free. Was the thought of the hour. Pilate really couldn't believe what he was hearing. So he made the offer a second time. Notice verse 20. Pilate, therefore, willing to release Jesus, spake again to them. But I believe it's intensifying now, verse 21, saying, crucify him. Crucify him. Before they said, away with this man. Now they're even more intense. Crucify him. Crucify him. Pilate then, for the third time, declared the innocence of Christ, and the response of the people is recorded in verse 23. And they were instant, without any thought, with loud voices, requiring that he might be crucified. The voices of them and of the chief priest prevailed. Now, according to Matthew's account, in Matthew 27, verse 26, Pilate then scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. Then notice if you go over to Matthew 27, Matthew 27, verses 27 through verse 31. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the common hall, gathered unto him the whole band of soldiers, and they stripped him and put on him a scarlet robe. When they had platted a crown of thorns, they put it upon his head and a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. And they spit upon him and took the reed and smote him on the head. And after that they had mocked him, they took the robe off him and put his own raiment on him and led him away to crucify him. So as the procession heads to this place of crucifixion, again from Isaiah 53, we see that the face of Jesus is more marred than the face of any man. The flesh on his back has been torn to shreds with the scourging. Muscles and tissues have been severely lacerated by the scourging. In front of Jesus are people, behind Jesus are people, and they're hurrying the procession along. And as they proceed, the disdain and the hatred and the scorn and the furious malice and the disgust and the hostility and the derision and the contempt toward Christ was building each step of the way. Again, this is a people that had more respect for two thieves than they did Christ. More respect for a man named Barabbas than they did Christ. What you have here is the spirit of Antichrist. It was a spirit of darkness and uncleanness and lies. Everywhere was a spirit of ignorance and rejection. It's a spirit that finds Christ to be the problem. Finds Christ to be an annoyance and an irritation. Finds Christ to be the lowest of the low. He was a deplorable in their sight. And all of this was building in intensity as they head to the place, Calvary. And by the time they get to Calvary, the hatred for Christ is in a frenzy, more than it was before. So you have the spirit of the whole scene. But then notice the activity. There were three crosses. On two of them you have two low-down thieves. And upon the center cross is Jesus. the Son of God. The people, they sit and watch. They stand and behold. And they pass by. And as they do so, the attention is upon that center cross. And it's obvious to anyone in that crowd that the one in that center cross is far more despised, far more hated than the two rotten thieves. It's very obvious that there is more scorn and disgust toward Christ than there was toward the thieves. More hostility and animosity toward Christ than the thieves. The one on that center cross was considered to be far worse than any thief, and was more intolerable than the thieves. And the people mock, and they taunt, and they ridicule, and no doubt they curse the one on that center cross. Now notice in Mark chapter 15, Mark 15, this is the activity that was going on during this time. Verse 29, and they that passed by railed on him, wagging their heads, shaking their heads like they're saying, "You fool." And saying, "Ah, thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it in 3 days, save thyself and come down from the cross." This was the folks that were just passing by. And then verse 31, likewise also the chief priests, the religious leaders, mocking and said among themselves with the scribes, "He saved others. Himself he cannot save. Let Christ, the King of Israel, descend now from the cross, that we may see and believe." And then we see they that were crucified with him, the two thieves, reviled him. Now back over in our text in Luke chapter 23. Notice verse 35 through verse 37. And the people stood beholding, and the rulers also with them derided him, saying, "He saved others. Let him save himself, if he be Christ, the chosen of God." And the soldiers also mocked him, coming to him and offering him vinegar, and saying, "If thou be the King of the Jews, save thyself." Verse 39, you see, the one thief at this time continues the mocking. So there the people are sitting, they're mocking. The ones passing by are mocking. Those that are standing are mocking. The one thief on the cross is mocking. This is, the setting is absolutely horrible. It's appalling. It's abominable. There is demonic disdain going on that day. Demonic malice and rage and attack toward Jesus Christ. Everywhere that day was mockery, and taunting, ridicule, and blasphemous insults hurled at Christ. And it was in this setting that the thief was saved, which shows the power of God to save a sinner. That God could save a sinner in that setting is amazing. But that's not our point tonight. But it's also in this setting that this thief, whom God saved, becomes a pattern to you and I. Because we live in very similar scene. We really do. And it is intensifying. And I believe it's demonic. Now, consider this thief as our example. First of all, as we saw this morning, he came under the influence of the almighty power of God. And you and I that are saved, if we're going to live for and serve God in a setting like this, we must be under the influence of the almighty power of God. There's no other way that it can be done. In Ephesians 5:18, we have this exhortation: be filled with the Spirit. There is no other way. If we're going to live for God, if we're going to serve God in this setting, in this scene, we must have the continual, ongoing overflow of the Spirit of God. We must be under the power and the influence and the effect and the sway of the Spirit of God. We can't do this in our own strength. It's going to take the power of God. So this thief, in this setting and scene of Golgotha, was hearing, was witnessing. Now at first he's right there, he's doing the same thing. But when God began to work with him, and as he was seeing and witnessing the hatred and the ridicule and the blasphemy spewing toward Christ, I believe it greatly saddened him. Because God is doing a work in his heart. But he's come under the influence of the power of God. That's necessary. But having come under the influence of the power of God, his whole mindset is different. Everything changes. The power of God made a difference in his life. Moments before, he was insulting and mocking and ridiculing Jesus Christ, sucked in by everything that was going on around him. But now he's under the power of the Spirit of God. God's working in him. And suddenly he's no longer sucked in by the evil influence all around him. The power of God upon our lives will prevent, not just help, it will prevent us from being taken in by the demonic influence all around us. It will cause us not to be engulfed in the evil influence and ways all around us and the vileness of the times. Suddenly this thief is of a different mindset. God's people are to be of a different mindset than the world. Especially as the hatred intensifies by the moment toward Christ, there ought to be a more marked difference. It should not be hard to see a difference between the people of the world and God and God's people. So he was of a different mindset. He had courage. He had courage. It was in this, again, remember the setting, remember the scene of Golgotha. And it was in that setting. I mean, most of the people there, probably thousands, were taunting Jesus Christ. But this thief has come under the influence of the Spirit of God.
And he has the courage in that setting to rebuke the other thief and speak upon the subject of reverence toward God. Notice verse 40. The other answering rebuked him. So that shows the tone in which these words were spoken. Dost not thou fear God? He's talking about reverence. He's in a scene where irreverence is everywhere. And this man, having come under the influence of the power of God, has the courage to speak, "You ought to reverence the Lord." He rebukes the other thief. Surrounded by demonic influence, in the very midst of disdain and hatred and malice and rage toward Christ, this man, under the influence of the power of God, said to the other thief, this other thief was spewing out hatred toward Christ, he says to him, "Dost not thou fear God?" He had the courage to rebuke him, the courage to, and the audacity to speak for the glory of God, the courage and the audacity to speak in the midst of abomination, and the subject he is speaking upon is reverence toward God. That needs to be us. We need to be a people of courage. We need to be a people of audacity to speak up for what is holy in the very midst of unholiness, and to speak up for what is right. And here we are today. Many people don't have enough sense to know that two men and two women should not get married to each other. That that's not normal. We need the courage and the audacity to speak up. It's wrong. It's sin. It's abomination. People today do not have the sense to know that fornicating is wrong. It's sin. We need the courage and the audacity to speak up. And this is what this thief did. And it is as a result of the God working in his life. He couldn't be quiet. Now, I do believe that most of us sitting here probably have less and less trouble, or we should anyway, considering the circumstances in which we find ourselves today. I don't find it real difficult to speak up. To me, it's getting easier to speak up. Before, perhaps you struggled a little bit, but it's getting easier to just speak out. We need courage. We need the audacity to speak in the midst of ridicule and the blasphemy. Also, this man recognized his own sin as a terrible thing. He stresses that in verse 41. In other words, he was not indifferent toward his sin. He was not proud of it. He was very much aware of his own sin. And the power of God upon our lives will not allow us to continue in sin. It won't allow it. It won't allow us to deny it. It won't allow us to ignore it. It won't allow us to justify it or minimize it. The power of God upon our lives will cause us to confess our own sin and hate it and to see what it deserves and to turn from it. This thief also, something else he did, was he called attention to Christ. Now all attention was already on Christ, but he changed the focus. He said there in verse 41, "This man hath done nothing amiss." The majority of that crowd saw him worse than the two thieves. You were not going to convince the majority in that crowd that Jesus Christ was not a criminal. They had already made up their minds. But this thief now, under the power of God, this man. Everyone is, not everyone, but most of the people are spewing blasphemous insults toward Christ. And he says, "This man has done nothing amiss." Between him and that thief is Christ, so he had to speak. He couldn't just whisper that. Other people heard him say it. "This man has done nothing amiss." He is saying this man is innocent. He has committed no sin. He speaks of the perfection of Christ. And he does so in the midst of darkness and ignorance and blindness and hatred. He does so in the midst of demonic rage. But when he said, "But this man," he drew attention to Christ. And that's what we need to do. In a world that's engulfed in filth, we must be able to say with certainty, "This man, Jesus Christ," must speak to our relatives, our neighbors, whoever. "This man, Jesus Christ." That was the message of this thief. "This man." We live in a time when people are absolutely duped. They cannot think for themselves. They are called progressives. Let me tell you where they're progressing to. Hell. Progressing further and further and further from God. We live in a time where people, we need to be able to say loud and clear, "This man. This man. Jesus Christ." You know what the homosexual needs to hear? "This man. Jesus Christ." You need to hear about Christ. The very one whom the masses of the people were directing their rage was the solution. He was the remedy for the need of that day. And he is today. He's the only remedy. He's the only solution. The government is not going to fix the problem. They don't even know what the problem is. The solution is Jesus Christ. The very one they hated was the one they so desperately needed that day. And that's why Jesus looked out upon them and said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And they didn't. But this thief directed attention to Christ, this man. We must do the same. Don't be ashamed of Jesus Christ. Then notice something else. He was not ashamed to acknowledge him as his Lord and King. Verse 42, he said unto Jesus, and the first word out of his mouth was Lord. Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. Now, if someone has a kingdom, they must be a king. He recognized Christ as Lord. He recognized Christ as King. We need the power of God upon our lives in the midst of demonic rage to be able to stand up and say, I'm not confused. I'm not unsure. I don't need any time to think about it. I identify with this man, Jesus Christ. That's what this thief was doing. He was now identifying with Jesus Christ. He's saying, he's my king. And this is in spite of everything that's going on that day. Lastly, he was not ashamed to be identified with Christ. Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. He is saying, Jesus, you're king. You have a kingdom that's not a part of that is not of this world. And I want to be identified with you. And I want to be identified with that kingdom. That's what we need today. No shame. To be identified with Jesus Christ. Also, though God's people are not perfect, as we all know, don't be ashamed to be identified with the Lord's people. I would much rather, I hope all of us would much rather be identified with the Lord's people, as imperfect as they might be, than with the hell's crowd. We identify with Christ, and He is perfect. And we identify with the Lord's people, and they're not perfect. But that's our crowd. And that's who we identify with. A person's crowd says a lot about them. It says a lot about them. And we ought not be ashamed to be a part of the Lord's crowd. So here we are, living in the setting and scene of Golgotha. We need to have the power of God working in our lives, making us different every single day. I don't understand why a child of God, especially seeing how far off track the world has become, not that they were ever on track, why any child of God would be concerned about being considered normal by the world is beyond me. The only thing they consider normal is just like them. So why would we even concern ourselves with what they think? Why would we even concern ourselves whether or not we're mainstream or not? I would be more concerned if I was mainstream. But the power of God lifted this man above what was going on. That ought to be happening every day in our lives. And I'll be honest, it enrages me to watch the news anymore. And I'm still foolish enough to do it every night before I go to bed. I just can't help myself. And then I go up and tell Sharon about it, and she says, I don't want to hear it. Don't want to hear it. But it enrages me. But it needs to do more than that. It needs to cause us to pray. Amen. I mean, I can get upset. But we need something more than that. We need to pray. We need to pray that God would save souls. God would open their eyes. We certainly need to pray for our government, those in power. And we need to pray for one another, that God would give us the power to speak up. God would give us the power to be what we ought to be. And that we would help one another, encourage one another to be what we ought to be in this world. Because we're in this together. And we need to stand for Him. But it takes the power of God. God help us. You see, this thief, in a lot of ways, is a pattern for us. And oh, for the courage to rebuke. Well, I don't want to make them mad. I got news for you. They're already mad. You're not going to make them mad. They're already mad. They might get more mad. But you're not going to get them mad. They're already mad. They've already lost their minds. Tell them the truth. They don't want to hear it. Tell them anyway. They don't listen. Tell them again. God, give us the courage. And God, give us the burden to do so. Brother Larry, if you come and lead us to verse